From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with the author Marcia Butler, whose new book is Oslo, Maine, released this spring by Central Avenue Publishing. Marcia Butler, a former professional oboist and interior designer, is the author of the memoir The Skin Above My Knee and debut novel Pickle's Progress. With her second novel, Oslo, Maine, she draws on memories of performing for 15 years at a chamber music festival in central Maine. While there, she came to love the people, the diverse topography, and especially the majestic and endlessly fascinating moose who roam at their perpetual peril among the humans. After many decades in New York City, Marcia now makes her home in Santa Fe, New Mexico. A moose walks into a rural Maine town called Oslo. Pierre Roy, a brilliant 12-year-old, loses his memory in an accident. Three families are changed for worse and better as they grapple with trauma, marriage, ambition, and their fraught relationship with the natural world. Oslo, Maine inspects the strengths and limitations of seven average yet extraordinary people as they reckon with their considerable collective failure around Pierre's accident. Alliances unravel, long-held secrets are exposed, and throughout, the moose is an ever-present linchpin driving Butler's story. When I spoke with Marcia Butler, we began with her reading an excerpt from near the start of the novel. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
Now full dusk, the temperature dropped quickly, causing the moose's skin to ripple from the chill. She navigated down the western slope, stepping around stubby brush and through residual patches of winter snow until she reached the bottom. This side of the hump appeared mostly devoid of edible plants and trees, though a nearby patch of fronds presented as a suitable bed. Just as she prepared to collapse her legs and lie for the night, she heard a familiar trickle. She approached the sound, which proved to be a stream, and placed one hoof in the water to test the depth. Satisfied that the stream was shallow, she extended her neck down to drink. The water gave off an acrid stench, and she quickly recoiled with aversion. This sudden reaction set in motion a chain of events. Something brushed her head, a tickle at her ears. She heard a series of snaps, and simultaneously, something that resembled a snake dropped over her head, encircling her neck. Startled, she backed away but was unable to move more than a foot. Walking forward into the putrid water also proved impossible. Spreading her four legs at slight angles in order to stabilize the weight of herself and her calf, she began to thrash her head back and forth, up and down. The snake thing tightened all the more. The moose, possessing exceptional hearing, rotated her ears in an attempt to locate other animals, but the area exuded a malevolent quiet, dangerous because she'd never encountered this particular predator throughout her 20 years in the natural world. And her strange captor seemed to operate with a native intelligence. It had managed to scoot up her long neck, past the dewlap, and was now tight at the cusp of her throat. She worked her tongue from side to side, attempting to swallow, but could only bark a cough brought on by the sustained constriction. Very soon, saliva frothed at her lips, and stiff hairs rose up on her shoulders and spine. The moose had entered a full panic. Over the course of the next hour, the moose made many attempts to free herself. She alternately strained mightily and then eased up when exhausted. Sustained moans meant to attract other moose as far away as 2 miles went unheeded. Finally, she gave herself over to capture, and once she ceased struggling altogether, the snake thing slackened its tension at her neck, almost as a reward for relinquishing all efforts to escape. There, standing at the lip of the stream, the moose and her unborn calf managed an uneasy sleep. Dawn broke, No other animals approached the stream as would be normal in the early hours, the water source surely known to be non-potable. If birds nested nearby, they remained silent. Indeed, as the sun rose in a cloudless sky, a barren land spread out before the moose. Bushes and trees appeared dwarfed. Like in the dead of winter, rather than flourishing with buds as would be expected in the spring. Any snow that remained was covered with black silk, encrusted across the surface. The moose, now fully awake to this strange landscape, felt a fresh urge to free herself. She recycled pointless movements and made weak calls to other animals. Her calf kicked at intervals, but before long went unnaturally still. Soon, thirst became her most pressing need. Though the stream was foul, the moose made one more massive attempt to get water down her throat. She pulled against the snake thing and managed to poke her snout a few inches into the water. Not only did her throat close up again, but overnight her tongue had swollen to almost twice its normal size, which rendered her incapable of swallowing. So whatever water did manage to seep into her mouth went nowhere. This was a bewildering confluence of restrictions she'd never known before. And as if to punish her further, the moose urgently, now more than ever, wanted to collapse to the ground. Yet each time she sank, the choking around her neck thwarted that need. In early afternoon, just as the moose had managed to relax into another dozing state, a noise from behind startled her. She was unable to turn her head, but recognized the sound as one she'd encountered near the paths on which humans traveled. The grinding noise grew in volume and stopped directly behind. The sound of four slams and approaching footsteps shook her. "It's a moose cow, a beauty," the human said.
What an interesting opening to start out in the point of view of the moose. And actually, the moose is sort of wanders through the narrative, as it were. So I wonder if you want to talk a little bit about making that choice. When did you write the moose's point of view? Was it something that came at the end of the process of working on the book, or was it something that you started with? Just whatever you might share.
Sure. The moose came in fairly quickly, I'd say. In the beginning of crafting the story, I had an idea of an inciting incident that had actually happened in a manner, not exactly in the book, but which I had actually been told a story in Maine. Of something that had happened with a moose. And that was when I became inspired by moose and became obsessed with them, essentially. This was in the late 90s. And I researched moose. I've always had an obsession with moose. So you know, in the back of my mind, unconsciously, I'm sure that I was always interested in having the moose be very present. And then very early on in crafting the narrative, I decided that she really needed to be in the book in a present, real way as having a point of view and actually have a pivotal role in the sense that she observes things in the book that the characters do not know. So the reader sees this, and it's a, you know, sort of portending to disasters or things that the readers are unaware of, and it's a problem. But the reader knows because they've read it from the point, Moose's point of view of what she observes in the wild. So it came in pretty quickly.
Yeah, it was very creative and a little terrifying, actually. I mean, that scene is terrifying. I won't go into it, but it's very moving and very intense. So you mentioned the inciting incident having had some basis in reality. Was that the idea for the book? Is that where you came? Was that your sort of like inspiration?
Yes. You know, I used to be a professional oboist.
Yes.
And I played chamber music concerts in Maine for many years. I'd go up for 1 week during the summer, and I got to know the people there. Of course, the people who ran the festival and the theater was always packed for the performance. They really, you know, loved this chamber music festival. And the head of the festival told me about an incident that she had with her husband driving late at night one night, and they hit a moose and they survived. The moose was killed instantly, thank God. And what happened the next day was very different from what is in my novel. I mean, I basically used that kind of scenario vaguely in the novel. It's not an exact, not nearly what happened to my friend Lori, but it was stunning. The windshield was broken, of course, shattered. She came home and found glass shards in her underwear.
Oh, wow.
And behind her contact lens.
Wow.
And of course, I couldn't put that in the novel because no one would believe it.
Yeah.
But it did happen. And actually, for accidents with cars, a small percentage of people actually survive those. Yeah. It's like 17 or 15% of people survive.
Right. Living in Vermont, I'm aware of why, you know, how dangerous that is. And if you hit a deer, and I did hit a deer a couple of years ago, and that's terrible and it's dangerous. But with a moose, the legs are so long that the body comes right through the windshield. You know, the legs get knocked out, the body comes in the windshield. And it's very, very unusual for someone to survive that.
It is. It's 1,500 pounds coming at you from a velocity because right. The car is in motion.
Right.
And it is catastrophic, usual.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about a character that we haven't seen yet in your reading, Pierre. He's a wonderful character. He's a young boy. How old is he? Is he 12?
He's 12.
He's 12.
Yes, he's 12.
And he's a great character. He's involved in an accident that has to do with the moose, which I won't go into great detail about. I don't like giving anything away in these interviews, although sometimes it's a little bit hard. But anyway, his mind and memory are affected by this accident. And I was very moved by him. He was a great kid. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about writing his character, creating his character, but also writing about somebody who's had a memory loss and writing about from the point of view of a kid, all these things.
Yeah, I mean, I have a lot of empathy for Pierre because he was a lot like me when I was young. Pierre has this accident and his memory is gone. I kind of made that up. I didn't, you know, strictly hew to memory loss due to accident, but I could, as a novelist, I could control, you know, how this was going to play out for him. So he remembers certain things, but he doesn't remember a lot of things. And one of the ways that he manages this in his life is he starts playing the violin, and his violin teacher, he's very prodigious. You know, he picks it up really quickly and he bonds with his violin teacher, right? So he's the little Sartre, you know, the existentialist in the novel. When I was young, I played the oboe, of course, at a very early age, and I was prodigious, and it helped me organize and organize my world, which was slightly chaotic when I grew up, right? And I really just was drawn to the instrument. It was always there. Music never failed me. It was this time and space where I could forget everything and just play. And this is really what Pierre's experience is. His parents are not up to the task of dealing with his injury, right? The father's blustery and the mother has her own set of problems. They deeply love him, but fortuitously, this violin teacher comes in and shows him how to play the violin. And through sound, Pierre understands that there is nothing more important in life than the here and the now. It's not the past and worrying about that. It's not worrying and fretting about the future. When he's playing the violin, he is present and he doesn't have to worry about his memory and what he doesn't remember and what he can remember and what he does remember, all the good things and the bad things. So he's kind of a very pure existentialist who is a very Zen kid, you know, and he also understands, he sort of gets all the adults around him who are failing him. Mm-hmm. He understands that.
Yeah, I liked his character. It's funny because the experience of playing the violin and how it helps him with his problems, it's funny, I felt like that was what the doctor in the book is trying to get at when he tells him to try the nothing exercise. And it's like losing yourself and letting go of thoughts, but it seems that music is the thing that brings that to him, you know, to him the best. So I kind of liked that.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's talk about Maine as a setting. I wondered a little bit about your own history with Maine. I know you say that you used to play in that chamber festival. Did you ever go there for longer periods of time, or were you mostly just fortunate enough to come in for that special week each year for a while?
Well, after I had never been to Maine until I had done that chamber music festival, and I immediately fell in love with the state. I mean, the topography is so diverse. Most people associate Maine with coastal Maine. Well, interior Maine is very different, and most of the population, of course, is down by Portland, which is a lively, incredible, you know, arts town, really. But when you get up into that central northern area of Maine, it is sparsely populated. It's a very different environment. And I was fortunate enough to go, as I said, for about 12 or 13 years regularly. But as the summers went on, I sort of packed in time before and after. So I would make a 1 week work situation. I'd get there a little early and I'd stay a couple of days and then I'd stay after. And it became my favorite state, really. I loved it. I loved the festival. I loved the people I was playing with. And I also spent time in Portland, and which is a hopping town. Even back then, it was really great. So it's an unusual town, and it's an unusual state, I should say. And I still am in contact with a number of the people who I met up there and forged relationships with. As a matter of fact, the woman that I stayed with was an older woman, is kind of archetypally one of the characters in the book. I know her granddaughter still, who lives in New York City, and I met her when she was 12.
Oh, wow. And that was that Edna's character?
That was Edna. Yeah. Yep. We've kept in touch. You know, she reached me when her mom, her grandma died.
Yeah.
And then we started a casual but nice relationship.
Nice. That's mm-hmm. great. Well, now I want to talk a little bit about one aspect of this book. So there are basically, I would say, three families or sets of people who are the primary focus of this storyline, and they kind of have interaction with each other. And you have this great line, and I'm not quoting it directly, I think I made a note, but it's not the direct quote, but it's got to do with knowing more than you should about a person or family. I believe it's when Sandra stops by Celine's house one time that she has this observation that, like, sometimes you don't want to know as much as you find out about a person or about a family. And there is this sort of, like, thread through the novel of, you know, the way that people affect each other, and sometimes we do or don't want to be in each other's lives to a certain extent. And I think that makes for good story, and I wondered if we could talk about that a little bit, just sort of like the ways that separate, distinct units of people become enmeshed and that can make good stories.
Yeah, sure. I mean, in small towns, I think this is particularly prevalent, this idea that, you know, be careful about what you think you want to know mm-hmm. about people that you live around. I mean, the Maine winters are very harsh. And, you know, in this case, in the novel, one family, the Roy family, is next to the Kimbrough family. They have acreage next to each other, and they're not the easiest of neighbors. But they know more of each other. They observe things that, you know, they may have opinions about and they don't agree with. But, you know, you basically in rural areas, you have to, in times of peril, really get together. Right. So when there's a storm, this one digs that one out. You know, there's a mention in the book when Pierre's mother was giving birth, just about to give birth. There was a blackout. So Sandra invited them over and they stayed over until the electricity was restored. So it's, you know, I think that close communities that have not a dense population, but know everything about each other, it's a good thing. It's a bad thing. It can cause problems. But I think, as I said, in times of struggle, they can come together because they do know each other, yeah. You know, and what we choose to ignore, what we choose to not talk about, what we choose to forget, you know, this is part of being human and being in community with people. Mm-hmm. So I was very interested in exploring this in the book. You know, everybody's into each other's business, whether they like it or not.
And then there's also this sort of wonderful focus on who takes care of whom in the world. You know, and relationships, you know, a mother taking care of a child, sometimes a child taking care of a mother, you know, a neighbor, a friend, a partner, who is in charge of whom, and who steps up. And that was kind of wonderful too, in a related way. Was that?
Right. Well, I can relate it to Pierre and his mother, Celine. She, when Pierre has his accident, the father, Claude Roy, loves his son deeply, but cannot really connect. You know, Pierre is a soft boy. He's prepubescent. He reads books. He's artfully inclined. And his father works in the lumber mill, and you know, basically wants his son to follow him. Pierre's mother is a housemaker. And she and her husband are in lockstep pretty much about everything and how they live and how they're raising their family, except Pierre has this accident. She devolves into not a full-out drug addiction, but she is relying on an oxy-like pill to help her through the days. And she does decline throughout the book. It's a very sad situation. And Pierre, of course, who's hypersensitive, becomes hyper-vigilant around his mother. He's aware when she's taken her pill. He hears her walk down the hall to the bathroom. He hears the cabinet open. He hears the rattle of the bottle. He hears the flush of the water. He knows his mom has taken a pill. Mm-hmm. He knows then what to expect from his mom in the next 4 hours. She'll recede to her bedroom. She won't come out. He'll know when to go and wake her. He'll have a tuna fish sandwich waiting for her. This is what children do when their parents have succumbed to addiction. And the guilt that the child feels also, that it's all his fault. He had this accident. He can't remember things. And so the parents who are supposed to be supporting him, you know, he's actually taking care of them. So this is part of the dynamic in the Roy family. And Pierre seems to have all the answers.
And it's interesting because he's at an age where he will soon start taking some steps forward into independence, right? And so the parents each have given him a little bit of time to himself in different ways. And so as a result, they both feel somewhat guilty about the accident, which, you know, I won't go into why, but each of them has their own sense of complicity in what happened, right? And I thought that was interesting too. I just think this novel does a beautiful job of developing characters and telling us about how they, you know, kind of move on from an event, an inciting event.
Right. And isn't it true that when these catastrophic things happen to children, there isn't enough guilt in the world to fill these people up?
Right.
I mean, and the boy as well. I mean, everybody is taking their share of, if only I hadn't done this, if only I hadn't done that. And it can go out and out and out, you know, exponentially out past them, you know, try to line up the dots of how this might not have happened in the first place, how their subsequent reactions to the child are wrong or right, enough, not enough, helpful, not helpful. And then it just goes on from there. And, you know, it's a tough thing for a small family to endure, especially with the personality types that I've created for them.
Right. Yeah. So another person or family unit in the novel is his violin teacher and her partner. And I was so interested in this part of the book. One of the things that I was really interested in is how affected she is in her background by the criticism of being ambitious. She was accused of being ambitious as a musician. And it's very offensive to her because she just started playing music out of the joy that she got from it. But I was really interested in that idea of ambition as a negative thing and being criticized for it, right? And I think you have to have ambition in order to survive in the arts. You just have to.
Right. You do. And, you know, it's interesting because as an oboist for so many years in New York, you know, needless to say, I've thought about this whole issue. I mean, first comes the talent, and we're born with the talent, right? And so in the book, this is this woman, Sandra Kimbrough, who is a violinist, and she is, you know, she lives in San Francisco. She gets married to this guy named Jim, who's a cellist, and they have different talent levels, right? So all growing up, Sandra Kimbrough was gifted, superbly gifted, and could have gone really to the top of her profession. And she was slated for that. And soon she found out that people had resentments about her, both parents of her friends who played instruments. And also when she got into conservatory, it's like, oh, yeah, you know, well, she's so good. And, you know, there's jealousy. There's, you know, really poor reactions to her ability to succeed. That's not to say that she did not work very hard. She had a prodigious talent and she worked greatly to sort of meld the two things, but always within with the notion that you're serving music, you're serving the composer. So she didn't really understand all of this. She was just doing, first of all, she was gifted, she was born with it. So why are people complaining about that? Second of all, it was her choice to try to get as good as she could, which she did. This is not a good, you know, this is perceived as, especially as a woman, it's like, who do you think you are kind of thing.
Right.
And it's kind of the golden triangle. You have to have a gift, you have to have discipline, and you have to have then an ambition to drive those two things forward. So she struggles with this. And then she realizes ultimately she doesn't actually want a job in a top orchestra. And there's a part in the novel which explains what happens when she and Jim are in San Francisco.
Right.
And she doesn't get that job.
Yeah.
And it propels them off to Maine. And so she kind of maneuvers this whole thing.
Right.
And it's a tricky thing when people are in a rarefied art form. Emotions, there's all manner of emotions around that. And it can be very difficult for a person who is supremely talented,
right,
as Sandra is in the novel.
So let's talk a little bit about your background. You were a professional oboist, and I take it that means you're not anymore.
I'm not. I retired in 2008.
Okay.
I did it for 30 years in New York City. Yeah.
And do you still play in any sort of less professional atmosphere just for the joy of it or to participate with a group?
You know, to the great surprise of everyone, no. I played my last concert in 2008 and I never picked it up again.
Oh, wow. It's like, what was his name? Who was the jazz? Artie Shaw.
Whoa.
Artie Shaw was like world famous and then he put it down and walked away. And that's very interesting. That's a very interesting story.
For me, I sold the instruments within the year. I mean, oboes do not get better with age like a violin. They need to be played. So I sold them. And, you know, it's being a professional musician at that level, you're at your top game every single day. It's yeoman's work and it's very stressful. And to put it down and let it go for 2 months and then pick it up and you sound bad, this is not what musicians want. It's kind of like being, say for instance, you were a first rate hurdler, like in a race, jumping over those jumps, and you got to top division or whatever, maybe you were even in the Olympics, who knows. And a year later, after getting your gold medal, you know, you decided, let me go and get out on that track and let me jump over those hurdles. And they're all, you kick them all down. This is not fun, you know. So the analogy is that, you know, if you don't sound really good at the top of your game, it's just not enjoyable.
Right.
You know, and I was ready. I had done most of what I wanted to do in the music profession. And I really just was like, this is enough. I'm going to do something else.
Yeah. Now, you've also been an interior designer, and this is your third book. You're an author. So how did those paths open up for you?
Well, towards the end of my music career, I was always interested in design. I think if I was a bit younger, I might have been an architect. But I went back to school and got a BFA in interior design, and I was still playing at the same time. And I started a business, which I had for 15 years in New York City. So I sort of just feathered over stopping playing with picking up on clients in New York. And then at the end of my design career, which I closed that business in 2015, a few years before, I was started to write for the first time in my life about creativity. And one thing led to another. It became a memoir. And then I wrote these two novels. But for me, all of these things, playing music, creating spaces, and writing, it's all storytelling. All crafting either a narrative or a space in which people can live and do what they want to do. And then, you know, straight up storytelling, either which was in my memoir and then in these two novels. I'm just very interested in the details of the human condition. Mm-hmm. And music expresses it in another way. You know, you're sort of channeling a composer's intent, whether you're doing it by yourself or within an orchestra. What is prime is what the composer means, the interpretation of that piece collectively, right? And so that is, you're reimagining each time a composer who may or may not be dead, you're bringing that composer's life and emotional context to life again. Mm-hmm. And putting interior design aside, because it's a little bit off the beaten path, it's the same way in writing. It's exploring the human condition, all their frailties, all their challenges, the beauty, love, hate, resentment, jealousy, all these things which make us up as human beings is very interesting to me. And it's all of it has been storytelling to me.
That's cool. I like that. You mentioned, and this is back in Sandra's perspective, there's a musing about music and understanding the essence of music. I thought that was an interesting section. It might actually have been a Pierre. I can't remember if that was Sandra or Pierre, but understanding the essence of music. And I wondered what that means to you as a musician or as a, you know, former musician.
Yes. You know, music is, it's called the universal language for a reason. You know, a toddler will get up and hear music and start to dance. Mm-hmm. That is just so primal. This kid can barely walk, but they want to move when they hear music. And there is no other art form that actually stimulates the human body and, you know, so purely in the brain of a toddler to move, right? And it is a universal language. It is something that breaks down barriers. People of all political persuasions, religions, cultures, race, ethnicity, when they get together and they hear music, there is nothing different about us. We're all collectively experiencing this sound, which in ourselves means something. It's an emotional connection. We relate to it in terms of in the moment experience. Also, sound waves are unending, right? We know that sound waves are connected to quantum physics, just the way that pitches, the intervals lay and the way that they resonate. You do octaves, perfect fourths and perfect fifths. There is a way that they resonate that is not like any of the other combinations of intervals. And we know that this is connected to quantum physics. And also, when you speak, your sound will go on forever, for a million years. It never stops. So this is all kind of, this is the way I pack in sound and music. It's about human beings, but it's also about the expanse of the universe. It's that big to me. I see it that way.
That's wonderful. I wasn't sure that I would know what I was asking enough to know if it was a good question, but that was a great answer. So
thank you.
Let's see. I want to get back to the book, but first I'm just going to ask, what have you read lately that you enjoyed that you might recommend to listeners?
Oh, I'd love to shout out a couple of books. I just finished Ann Patchett's The Dutch House. Mm-hmm. I think that's her latest book. She's a wonderful storyteller, absolutely first rate. I absolutely loved it. I love her work. Now, a couple of other books that I've read recently that I love, an author named Bill Rohrbach, R-O-O-R-B-A-C-H. He's a really a wonderful author. He wrote a collection of stories called, I think it's called The Girl in the Lake, and which it was my first foray into his writing. He's this fantastic literary writer, just a storyteller beyond belief, and I recommend everyone to read his work. Who do I love also? Well, I mean, I read recently a nonfiction, but it came out about a year ago, is Say Nothing, about Dolores Price, who was in the IRA. And it's a fascinating and well researched, and the prose is the language is beautiful, about the IRA the bombings during the Troubles, and she's a fascinating figure in that. The other one I like, if I might mention, and he's got a new book coming out, is Jonathan Lee, who's actually the head editor at Catapult Publishing. He wrote a book called High Dive, fantastic. Absolutely fantastic book. He's great. Jonathan Lee, L-E-E.
Okay, wonderful. Great. And what are you working on now? Are you working on anything new?
I am. I'm into my third novel. I'd say, you know, it's about a quarter way through of the first draft, of course, which is changed greatly as we go through it. It's about a young girl who has her parents are of Irish extraction. And she's 20 years old, and, you know, it's a little murky now in terms of what's going on with her, but I'm fascinated with her. She's a girl growing up has been bullied. She's overweight. She's not particularly attractive. And she's trying to break out of her background, of her Irish parents would like her to work in the family business. And she is eager to do something else. And she's prodigiously intelligent. She has a photographic memory. She's got a lot of talents, but have not been recognized. Mm-hmm. So she's got a really, really interesting trajectory for her. But that's what I'm messing around with right now.
And have you found her? Like, do you feel like now the writing is starting to be about a real person as opposed to the person you're sort of trying to develop?
Well, that's a great question. I find that throughout writing a novel, I'm finding my characters throughout. I'm trying to find out who they are. So to answer this question, this is one, Oslo, Maine is in multiple points of view. This one is going to be one point of view, close person third, this girl whose name is Penelope Ryan. And I find myself spending a lot of time on the first 80 pages over and over because I really am trying to dig into her. I have no other character to go to sort of distract myself as a second point of view, a third point of view. And I want to know who this girl is so badly. And I am starting to dig in there. Finally, this last month, I find like, okay, now I have a way in. This makes sense. So while I'm writing her, I'm asking, she does things, she says things, and I'm asking myself, would she do that? Would she say that? And I have answers now, you know, more so than at the beginning where I'm just sort of, I don't work with outline. I write. I have the inciting incident that I think might be interesting to write towards and away from. Sometimes that happens, sometimes that doesn't.
All right, great. One thing that happens in Oslo, Maine, and I don't want specifics because this is getting into a farthest along part of the book that I don't want to give anything away, but one theme does have to do with women stepping back from their goals in order to accommodate men. And, you know, I suppose this is probably true of partners regardless of sex, but I think historically it's been women who did the stepping back. On top of that, the thing we already talked about where Sandra says, you know, that ambition, she sort of processed that as a criticism. Her partner says, you know, musicians do their work out of love. He's sort of saying that they should be only in chamber orchestras or whatever. So anyway, I thought that all of that together kind of might add up to an interesting conversation about avoiding self-sabotage in artistic pursuits, which are, I think, always very hard. And I think it's true for writers as well. And I just wonder if you have any thoughts along those lines.
Right. Wow. Yeah, that's a very deep topic. So I framed this whole question in the marriage of Sandra and Jim Kimbrough, where one person is the more talented and the other is less talented, but has a lot of ideas about being a musician in the world, right? So he's the one who has the edicts and, you know, the ways that things should be. And yet he's the one who really doesn't excel at his art form. And so through the prism of this marriage, and it's more universal than just these two people, but what do we do in our relationships or our partnerships? What do we give up in service to partnership? And as you say, well, I mean, when children are involved, in which this is not the case with Sandra and Jim Kimbrough, when children are involved, decisions have to be made in terms of hierarchy of what becomes important in the family structure. And how does that play in when people are in the arts, when they do have, they don't have a 9-to-5 job, they have to practice their instruments, you know, at night or in the day so that they can be ready for performances and rehearsals. And it's a tricky slope, you know, if you have two musicians in the family, for instance, who is going to take care of the kids when one person practices? So, you know, and you both have to be, you know, nail your parts when you get into the situation of rehearsal and performance. So I think it's a really hard thing to be in partnership with another person who's in the arts, because life intrudes and it's very hard to, you know, have an equitable give and take on that. And that's really what I was trying to explore in Sandra and Jim Kimbrough in the novel, is the disparity of talent, the disparity of workload. Sandra takes up teaching because they aren't making enough money and Jim puts her down for it, you know? So it's kind of, you know, it's a no-win situation.
Yeah. So that really kind of frames it as far as the novel goes. But as far as advice for writers, I'm thinking about the ways that we sabotage ourselves using kind of almost any excuse as a reason to procrastinate, to not send work out, to avoid success. And I don't know why it seems to be a theme with some writers. And I'm wondering if it's a theme with some artists. But I feel like there's kind of a generalized insecurity around wanting to succeed, around finding, for example, ambition to be a negative thing that you could be criticized for. And I think there, as far as just like offering advice to writers, do you have any suggestions along those lines?
Absolutely. I really think about this all the time, and I talk to writers about it. You know, I was a musician, so I developed, you know, a lot of discipline. The thing about writing, I think there's a certain amount of shame for writers of taking the time that they need to be selfish, calling it selfish. You know, say they have a busy family life and, you know, they want to take an hour out and, you know, but they're not present for their family. And there is this often this tug about this, which is crippling in itself, right? So you don't write for the hour because people are on your apron strings, metaphorically. And then if you do, you're being selfish, right? So what I tell people is that you find the amount of time each day that you know you can do. Say you're ambitious and you say you have a family, you have a job, whatever, and you want to write 2 hours a day. Well, that might not be actionable. It might not be successful day after day after day. What you do is you find the amount of time, and it might be 15 minutes, that you know anybody can do anything for 15 minutes or 5 minutes, if that's the case, right? And so what I suggest that people do is to find that sweet spot of time and stick to it. And when you are successful doing, say, half an hour, every day for 2 weeks, that's an accomplishment. And you would be really surprised about how that will build and build and build. And you realize that you can get quite a lot of work done in 1.5 hour of concentrated work, where you just turn off the phone, you turn off the computer, you close the door and say, don't bother me. Sit down and write. Sometimes it might be thinking and writing. Sometimes it might be revising. Sometimes it might be fresh words, you know, but if you keep it consistent every single day and do not give up on yourself, you'll be surprised at how much writing you can get done in doing that. And the key is to pick the amount of time that you actually can do, not the amount of time you think you should be doing or you'd like to be doing, or wouldn't it be nice if. That's a fantasy. What is necessary is that you understand yourself, your family situation, your work situation, so that if it is 5 minutes, so be it. Hopefully it'll be 15 minimum. It might be 20 or a half an hour. That's what you need to do.
That's great. That's wonderful advice. I want to mention again, the name of the book is Oslo, Maine, a novel by Marcia Butler, published by Central Avenue Publishing. And I want to thank you very much for talking to me today about your book.
Thank you. It's been a great pleasure. Thanks for having me.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview with the author Marcia Butler. You can learn more about her work at marciabutlerauthor.com. This week's Write the Book prompt was generously offered by my guest, Marcia Butler, who suggests writing a 1,200-word short story in the first-person point of view. But do not use the pronouns I, me, or my until at least halfway through, and preferably until the very end. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. Here's the Bookworm's calendar for the coming week. Phoenix Books presents a virtual conversation between June Zanes Garin and Kevin Pence about Garin's book, Hey, I Could Use a Little Help Here, on the topic of violence in the workplace, Tuesday, June 15th at 7. More information at phoenixbooks.biz. The Northshire Bookstore, Manchester Center, and Saratoga Springs, New York, has a lot of events this week, so I'm just going to read them all. They're all virtual Northshire Live events. Join at home for a literary conversation. Philip Dianieri presents The Appalachian Trail, a biography in conversation with Randy Minotaur, Monday, June 14th at 6. Larry Kerwin presents Rockaway Blue in conversation with Matthew Fitzpatrick, Tuesday, June 15th at 6. Random House has a virtual book launch for Lin-Manuel Miranda's In the Heights. It's a virtual book launch that will take place Tuesday, June 15th at 8. Northshire Live presents Camille Aubrey with The Godmothers, Wednesday, June 16th at 6. And Jean Hamf Korelitz presents The Plot in conversation with Rebecca Mackay, Thursday, June 17th at 6. All of those you can find more information about by going to northshire.com. And then speaking of the Northshire, it's one of many bookstores featured in a new film that's been released called The Books Tour. It's the story of one man's road trip to 50 indie bookstores in 50 days. Got to do with the Book Industry Charitable Foundation. You can read more about all of this and what the film is doing at the bookstourfilm.com website, bookstourfilm.com. Dorset Theater Festival presents Summer Reading Adventure Kickoff event at Southern Vermont Arts Center. They'll be discussing Anne Braden's Flight of the Puffin, Friday, June 18th at 3. More information at dorsettheaterfestival.org. And then the Vermont Studio Center will host a virtual reading event for the new issue of Green Mountains Review. That's issue number 32.1. Tuesday, June 15th at 7. More information at vermontstudiocenter.org. And then finally, the Vermont Studio Center has two virtual events. Their visiting writer right now is going to be Christopher Castellani, and he's going to be doing a reading Thursday, June 17th at 7. And a craft talk Friday, June 18th at 10. More information at vermontstudiocenter.org. So as I say every week, repeating myself at this point, given the pandemic, it's really hard for authors to get the word out about their books, so you can do them a real favor by finding their books. They could use your support. So attend their online events, read their blogs, follow their virtual book tours, and try to find your way to their books. For all of you who are trying to write these days, do be sure to check the archives of Write the Book, because each episode offers a prompt written out on the podcast site under the recorded interview. I would love your feedback about the show. Please, sit down, write me a quick email, let me know what you think. The email address is writethebook@gmail.com, and I will write back to you. If you'd like me to interview certain authors, or if you have events to announce, send those to that same email address, writethebook@gmail.com. Be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com. We are also on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and Pandora and lots of other podcast sites. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates, and you can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you like Write the Book, please rate it where you find it, like it on Facebook, tweet about it, and talk about it. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3 WBTV.org. Stay well and have a great week.